You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. The devil are you? You good? You had a good week? Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us and downloading. This is the Two Shot Podcast, and it's episode 16 with Tony Pitts. Now, if you don't know the name Tony Pitts, you might know the voice, you might know the face. I first came across Tony when I saw the second part of the Red Riding trilogy that Tony Grassoni wrote a few years back, which was fantastic, and I was really enjoying it. And on the screen pops this guy who I'd never seen before, and he kind of stole it for me. He out-acted everybody without acting. I just felt like he was right out of that period, and he kind of blew me away. And I've been lucky enough to work with Tony twice. And we've become good friends, and I'm thrilled that he said yes to coming on the Two Shot Podcast. This is it. This is episode 16 with Tony Pitts. I really hope you enjoy it. I will be back right at the end. Don't fast forward at the end. Don't cut me off. I've got some important stuff to tell you. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and I shall see you in a bit.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
We're rolling. This is brilliant. How's your tea, Tone?
All right. Well, green. It's all right. It's like green tea.
Do you want to turn your phone off?
Yeah, I'm going to turn it off now.
Because you know we've started.
Oh, okay. Well, we won't be phone going off halfway through.
Well, don't. Stranger things have happened during these podcasts, Tony. Don't worry about it.
Look, that would have been a baseline phone going off.
He's popping his leaves in his brew. And we're ready to roll.
Right. You don't want any opening remarks, do you?
No, I do that. I do that later.
Oh, you do that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Tony.
Yeah.
Pitts, how are you?
I'm all right, I think, yeah. In myself, I'm all right, yeah. Yeah, it's all a bit of a minute to minute, isn't it, really? You know what I mean?
Because we've just come out of... I don't want to get into work too much, but I do want to say that we've just come out of a screening of your film.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
How do you feel not seeing yourself? I mean, as well as seeing yourself on there, all the words coming out of those mouths, because you wrote it. How does that make you feel as opposed to just being an actor?
Well, seeing myself is, I've been doing it 36 years, and I don't ever watch anything that I'm in unless I absolutely have to. So, and this year, I've absolutely had to because I've got mine, and I've done Journeyman with Paddy Considine, so I've had to watch. So that's always horrific.
Is it because you don't like... I mean, I know loads of people don't watch because they don't like it, but you don't... And I've interviewed some of the younger people, and they do say, oh, well, I do like to watch because I feel like I can learn.
I'm always wary of people talking about learning. I don't quite know what that means, really. I understand the concept of learning. But I think it's creative instincts, and I don't think they're learned. You stop watching other people. I don't quite understand how that. I'm not without intelligence. I understand what people are saying, but for me, My main reason for not wanting to see myself is that I always think it's dreadful.
And you can see the cracks.
That's all I can see.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all I can see. Yeah. I don't see anything else other than... And I've never... And I know the... what a grown-up does, it's not a complicated lesson, is somebody says, if somebody pays you a compliment, you say, thank you. And I mastered that briefly in my mid-30s for about a year with like a rictus smile, I'd say thank you. But I always try and talk them out of it, really, because I don't... on recent acting jobs, it's never been more apparent to me and prevalent and right in front of the face. To me, it's the death. Literally, I've been in vans full of actors coming back from jobs where they're high-fiving each other, saying, I smashed it. And I think I don't understand that. I thought that feels like a death to me. I think that you should always be reaching to be authentic.
Yeah.
So it's hard watching myself, not great.
But as a writer, do you feel the same awkwardness watching your words?
Yes.
Dear.
Yeah.
Are you very judgy in that respect?
It's never good enough because I don't think it's a fully formed thought, but somewhere inside me in my story, my narrative, my version of me is that if I say something and I'm happy in the way I've said it, then I'm not going to speak again. And making a film writing a film feels like saying something when you're with people and they say, oh, that's great, say that again, and then you say it, and then people start to say, well, just enjoy that you've said it, and my instincts are to be, well, I want to say something else.
Yeah.
So that's how it is with me. It's all, it doesn't really bear examination. It's fucking exhausting for people around me. I'm probably best left just to sit quiet. But no, but then I see this in, so my, the people that I love in this world and the small group will love me back are all made the same way, shaped the same way. Richard Hawley, my dear, close, beautiful friend Richard wrote, scored the music.
Which is beautiful. It really, really works.
Heartbreaking,
for
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but Richard's, it's never going to be right for him.
Isn't that fantastic? That's what we're, I mean, that, as he said, there's a small group of us who are like that, that we just, no, it can't be good enough.
Because then what? Well, then what if it was, then what if it is good enough? Then what do? Then
stop. Yeah.
So that to me seems, it's almost implicit in every creative exchange, but that doesn't seem to be the orthodoxy. It feels like, and increasingly feels like that it's... So I've been doing it for a while, like 35 years or something. It feels like... it's almost that group thing that we smashed it, we did great, didn't we? That was amazing. And it was... That makes me want to choke myself.
Let's not be too self-congratulatory.
Because then you stop, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Because then you've been heard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you miss back Yorkshire? Do you miss being there? Because you don't live there anymore, do you?
No, I don't miss it. I don't...
When did you leave?
We moved to Brighton about 8 years ago. I've not just been in Yorkshire, I've strayed over the border into Lancashire.
Don't say bad things about Lancashire.
I don't have that in me.
This is the podcast. This is the War of the Roses.
I don't have that. I've never got. Again, I don't get
me
that.
Me neither. With that. Yorkshire, I love Yorkshire.
It's
a generational thing.
It's reductive, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, I don't. I don't care. Richard wrote a beautiful line that sometimes it's not where you're at, it's where you're from. And I think that's still evident. But no, I've got that thing of I move a lot. I suspect that I'm probably running from something that's running inside, but I do move like every 4 years, 5 years, we'll uproot and move somewhere else. And I always take one last look at the place that I'm leaving. And then I used to think it was a kind of disconnect in me, but I think it's probably a kind of protection. And I think I have that with acting jobs. And again, I know this is shared by my friends. So when it's a picture up or when it's at the end of a shoot, the second I've said the last word, it's gone. It's gone from me. Yeah, and I think that probably is. I don't know what it is. I could, you know, you never really know what you think about anything until you get asked. Do you? Do you know what I mean? And then you say it.
And even then
you don't.
Don't really.
No, you just say the thing that comes into you. Yeah. So I'm not so sure. But I don't miss... Yorkshire's still there. And the Sheffield that I left in the early 80s. I keep referencing Richard, but it's a good anchor for me because he stayed and I left. And the town that I saw, I couldn't wait to get away. I ran out of Sheffield in the early 80s. And Richard stayed, and I go back there now. And of course, it's not the, nothing's ever really what you think it is, you know. It's everything's always more complicated.
Can we just talk about growing up in Sheffield?
Sure.
How was it growing up there? For you personally?
Yeah. Right. Well, I'll start with I don't know, and then because I don't know, I'll give you.
Was it just you, or is it?
No, I'm the oldest of three boys. I was the oldest boy of. I am the oldest boy of a steel worker, and my mum works in old people's home, and I.
Do you have a good relationship with your brothers?
With my brothers,
yeah,
yeah. I don't have a bad relationship. I think the truth is I'm. And I felt all my life, and I think this is one of the themes of Funny Car. I've always felt like a cuckoo, really. I've always felt like not in the right nest.
Right.
Necessarily. I don't mean that. I built a lot of armour in my early years. I realised that I put, you know, I'm covered in tattoos, did boxing and muscled up and all that. So I put lots of armour on as a kid.
To protect from what?
Because I think if I look like how I feel inside, I'd look like Charlotte Bronte. I think that I made that mistake as a kid of comparing my insides to people's outsides.
Right.
I think there was a lot of that going on. And I also think...
Do you think that's to do with just that it was just within you, or was it something with school? Or?
No, I think it's how you're made. I've resisted therapy, or the few I've had calamitous experiences when I've tried to unravel, because I think it is a kind of unraveling. I don't really know. I have big sense memories of being a kid growing up in Sheffield. I remember that I could be funny. I remember that being, and I thought, oh, quite like that.
When you were little?
Yeah.
Making
the adults laugh. Yeah, making that. And even, I remember making angry adults, seeing anger in the face, and then they'd have to turn away because I'd made them laugh. And I thought, oh, that's quite useful to me.
Because you've got into them somewhere.
So, and then I found, and I think in retrospect, so I went to a comprehensive school, average class size 55. It's a crazy big tumble.
God, that is a
tumble dryer of a school, man.
By nowadays standards, no, that's a bloody big
crazy
class. Man.
It's crazy. But I think, see, all these things are difficult because they sound so self-regarding. But
well, don't worry about that.
I think I had emotional intelligence. I think I was quite a smart kid emotionally. I think I understood people's motivations and behaviour weren't necessarily the same thing. So then I had to find a space to operate in. So I was just funny. And then if there were family gatherings and if there were... I was always had a radar for the awkward silence, and I'd immediately fill that like builder's foam. I'd jump into that and fill the space. And then that became a kind of self-loathing because I'd think, why are you... You don't have to, do you know what I mean? So I'd entertain them, and then I'd be exhausted. You know, sick of hearing me on.
Already judging yourself.
Yeah.
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 Did you enjoy school, or is it just part of the course?
I made it in, like, I think I've repeated this pattern through my life. I made my own reality within it. Again, that sounds... But I did make my own. So we came to an agreement at the end. They said if I...
You in the school?
Yes, me in the school. If I wasn't disruptive and didn't lead others into inappropriate behaviour, I could bring a radio and sit in the cupboard in Val, the secretary's office. That was the accommodation.
Were you disruptive?
Yeah, but not in... Oh, it's all right, somebody's...
It's okay.
It's okay. I think we've got to recognise that somebody came to the room that I didn't just have a complete...
someone was just creeping down the stairs where we are.
Yeah. No, I was disrupted, but I don't think in a... I mean, I organise... I remember... Yeah, I mean, I probably was disruptive. I was disruptive, but I think I'd like to think in a... There was some art in it. Do you know what I mean? I like to think that there was some art in it. I wasn't... Nasty. I remember having I was disruptive, but I think it was more. I organised bingo
at school.
So I used to in the lessons from lesson to lesson, I'd give kids bingo cards and then call the numbers during the lessons. And you could do line or house, and then eventually Stephen Elliott shouted house really loud and it all came crashing down. And that was more that it's not that I wanted to play bingo, I had no interest in bingo, but I do remember liking the idea of there being another culture within that. So where they thought they were teaching us about Pythagoras' theorem, somebody was actually waiting for 27 for a line. I like that.
I like that.
Right.
That's fantastic.
Right.
Did you have a good set of friends at school?
They turned on me. They sniffed me out. I played myself. I played a version of myself. I played that sort of...
I think we all do that.
We do that, yeah. Yeah. Then I think as the years went by, it became apparent to them, as they started turning up in... see-through plastic shoes and enjoying Shakespeare and Laurie Lee and I think there was a bit of a sniffing out went on, and there's but that's the beginning of what like it seems essentially life is, which is finding your people, right?
Finding
your people.
It's an interesting thing you say that because I was listening. To you, bloody hell, this podcast sponsored by Rich Dawley. Rich Dawley comes up again with you and Richard on the Radio 4 thing.
Yeah.
And I think it was you that said, you know, we and I'm not quoting, but something like, you know, we spend our life looking for our people and who are our people. Yeah. And once we find our people, that's it.
I
completely agree with that. My wife always says, yeah, but Craig, you know, they're not your people or they're not my people.
So
I think it's a beautiful phrase. I don't hear it said by many people. So when you said it on the podcast, it really pinged out because I immediately knew what you meant.
And that beautiful thing of so I'm 55 in a couple of weeks, that beautiful thing of, because you kind of think, I've found them. They're in, you know, you make that mistake in your 20s and your 30s, you think they're your people, but they're not your people, they're just visitors. But that's all right, they're just there for that part of the ride.
Yeah.
But the beautiful thing is I've found, in the last 10 years, I've found two or three people that are, you know, out of a clear blue sky. That and the sense of, it's just that thing of, I think it's your starting point with people. So you're talking rather than explaining. Not, do you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
So we're not explaining or having to feel the weight of each other. You just,
and in a way, it can be effortless.
Yes, it is, yeah.
And I know when I found those people because I feel very relaxed in myself. I don't feel nervous.
That's right.
And you can I don't feel judged.
Yes.
Especially if I worry that somebody is better educated than me.
Right.
What if they're judging me?
Right.
And if I'm talking to someone and I don't feel it, I feel, oh, great.
Well, right, right, yeah, sure.
You know, it's your constant... Sure. I have that worry within myself. But if I feel... relaxed.
Well, it's yeah. I mean, painfully simple thing. But be as you wish to seem. I remember reading that as a 12-year-old, and the full weight of that keeps on landing. Be as you wish to seem, and to be able to be you. And because only you know what a terrible person you are, right? You know all the terrible thoughts you've had, all the terrible deeds you've. Only we know that. So it seems to me that it's about accepting yourself. You know, it's about accepting who you are, and that's. And I think that depends where you start. You know, but I think your starting point dictates a lot about you later. Years. What you see is down for people. What you think's down for you, for your life. See, I didn't grow up in an environment where there were actors and writers. I didn't see actors or writers or musicians or artists. I didn't see them.
So when did that come into your life?
Because Ken Loach picked me. I was I would contend without any fear of contradiction. I was the world's worst truck mechanic. In Sheffield, and Ken Loach picked me from obscurity at the age of 19 and gave me a second lead in his film Looks and Smiles, and
which was the Barry Hines?
Barry Hines,
yeah. And how did he find you? Because was he coming around?
Yeah, came to college. Came to college and to, you know, so our class of sausage-fingered truck mechanics, and I was one of them, and said, imagine if somebody stole in your motorbike, how would you react? And then there were four or five stumbling attempts, and then when it was my turn, I just went fucking ballistic. You know, I reacted the way that...
That you would?
That I would.
Yeah.
The way that boy would have.
Yeah.
And then they called me back, and it was still all very unclear. That was like the Thursday, and then they rang over the weekend, and on the Tuesday I'd left Kennings, sold the wood chisel that I had, that was my only tool that I had, and started working on the film Weekend Lounge.
Did you think at that point, oh, I think this is it. I think this is the journey I need to go on. It hadn't really surfaced consciously, had it, before now?
Okay, and this is where... maybe it's an age thing. Maybe it's that the confidence or the arrogance of youth or something. I kind of... I wasn't surprised. And I kind of thought, oh, you're here then.
Yeah.
Strange, huh?
Yeah.
Because there was nothing around me to... I had a spooky auntie. And this isn't any sort of woo-woo. It's not that. She just... I remember, you know, she's saying, oh, he's going to be writing books, or he's going to be... Well, you know, it was that. So it was sort of in the...
In the ether.
It was in the ether.
Yeah.
It was in the ether. And then when they came, I just remember my shoulders dropping a bit. And then I overinvested in those people. I thought that they made sense of me to me. I thought, I'm like all of these people. And of course, you know, you're not like all of any group of people. We're all individuals. But
did you feel part of like a clan or some sort of family?
Yes, I did.
And then when that ended, do you think when your first job? We'll see each other next week.
I did think that. I felt what my main memory was just terrible, grasping, choking anxiety of them leaving. I remember there was a what I now know to be a rap party in a hotel in Sheffield, and it occurred to me that they were going and. And they weren't taking me with them. It's a circus come to town, and then they left. And I remember thinking, and I wrote to Ken saying, I don't want to go back to where you found me. So that was my thing. But I also did think that, yeah, it did take me a little while to realise that it's just a job.
Yeah.
It's just a job, and you're not going to see everybody every week for the rest of your life. After you finish it.
So did you feel quite lost after that?
Yeah, I felt cast adrift. I felt sort of... but you know what? I did this thing that I used to do a lot when I was young. I taught my own future. Lying is another word for it. So I remember saying, people saying, what are you going to do now? And I remember saying, oh, I'm going to be on Coronation Street, or I'm going to do it in Emmerdale Farm, or what. I said, and then those things happened.
But was that out of, did that come out of embarrassment because people would know that you've done this film and you wanted to tell them, carry on, that you were being successful?
Later on, it would have been embarrassment and status. I completely understand that. I think later on when you come out of a job and, you know, because I was in Emmerdale for 11 years, when I left that,
how long was that after the Ken Loach film?
Oh, I got off of Coronation Street in Emmerdale. I did a theatre tour of Trevor Griffiths's Oi for England, and then I got off of the street in Emmerdale at the same time, so I went pretty much straight on. And then I left Emmerdale. I was sort of jumping ahead, but when I left Emmerdale, I couldn't get arrested for about a year. I don't know, it might have been a couple of years. And then it was that, you know, what you're doing... I couldn't crumble and do a regular job because I felt like it's a bit of a house of cards.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You've got to kind of live there. Got to pay your dues, I think.
Yeah.
You've got to pay your dues a bit. And
how did you feel at that time when you couldn't get arrested? And you know that you can't go and do, quote unquote, a normal job.
Yeah. Smoked about 2 tons of weed. I played my guitar 5 hours a day and I wrote for 5 hours a day.
So the writing was already in there.
So what would have been regarded as downtime turned to be uptime because that's where I just wrote. Not very good when it's a podcast because you can't see the available space, but the space that we're sitting in now, half of it I would have filled with my writing. I wrote films and books and plays and poetry and...
Just anything. Anything and everything to be creative.
Because I had no choice and I learned about myself there. I learned about who I am during that time.
Funny that sometimes when... We've got no choice, or we're backed into a corner. What do you do? Do you slide down the wall? Do you come back and you go, right, well, I've got to do it. You've made me do this now, I've got to.
I have no strength. I have no sense of nobility. I've never... People have said to me, who knew me through that time and then have known me through subsequently through the good years, have said, oh, you deserve it and, you know, you always knew you... But there's no sense of noble struggle. I literally... I haven't had a choice. I didn't have a choice. I couldn't. It wasn't. I'll show you. I didn't wake up thinking I'll show you. If I didn't get the stuff out that was running inside me.
Yeah.
Not good. You know, not good. I'd still suffer from insomnia now, but yeah, I've got, you know, it's yeah, it'd be a complete collapse. I have to
release.
Yeah, I've got to.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And did you feel just jumping back to working on the Ken Loach film? Because you never had you done any sort of like drama clubs or anything like that prior to
as it? A punishment at Myers Grove. As they one of the punishments they gave me. There were two in both. Similar stories, but one was at Myers Grove, being disruptive again, and the punishment for that was to go on stage and to do a stage death in front of the school. I can't remember the details of it, but I had to die on stage with a sword, and I remember taking about, you know, I milked it for about 3 minutes until I actually laid on the stage, and so that was a punishment because the implicit in that was the idea was you're being punished by it. Now we're going to punish you by giving you lots of attention,
giving you some airtime.
Wow, right? Yeah.
Punishments at that
because it's Poppy syndrome, right? It's yeah. That don't, you know, make a fool of you, don't. So that, and then equally, when I was a truck mechanic, I mean, that was, we won't go into that because that's probably, we're probably getting into libel, but I was, I mean, I was, that was physical violence that I fought there for because they were, you know, I was fighting with them. They were hitting me and holding me down and strapping me and trying to make me, you know, comply. And one of the punishments they'd give, that every Christmas they got the apprentices to stand on the back of a lorry and sing a Christmas song. And so the place would be full of blushing apprentices, terrified. I got a pink tutu thing that I got from Eries Road in Sheffield and wore that. And I was on the back of the lorry for, you know, 45 minutes. It couldn't get me off. as I often do, I've lost a thing. What I did.
Did you feel that you were... Did you feel you were learning on the Ken Loach film?
No,
not at all.
No, but I've heard other people say this because I don't. It's probably, I don't know if it's even worth examining. I don't. It's instinct. And the only time I've got in trouble creatively or in my life is when I've not followed my instincts. So I don't mean my instincts are right.
No.
Don't mean that I'm going to, you know, and I'm sure, and I've read quite subsequently, I've read a lot about this. There's a great book about thin slicing, about it's the moment of, the thing that excites me, the thing that I live for is the spark of invention. So the minute they say action and you do that. So I don't have the capacity, maybe it's a failing, I don't have the capacity to learn because then I think I'd start wandering towards mimicry and then it'd feel inauthentic, then I'd start being more self-conscious and fall in. So
well, that really is the house of cards, isn't it?
Because if
it's not steeped in reality, then it ceases to become truthful.
And we've worked together. The other thing that is, I will always... you know, I'll try and do something different on each take, even if it's tiny. Just, you know, that idea of...
But I think sometimes you have to do that for yourself. You have to do that for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely, I think you'd otherwise... I couldn't... Yeah, then it becomes a different thing, right?
Yeah.
If you have to, yeah, and yet I've always had problems with that, the continuity thing, you know, the spoon was in your right hand when you said that and then you scratched your left cheek. I've always found that puts me in a tailspin. It's part of the job, right?
Yeah,
And then you've got to learn it, but that still puts me... So learning, I don't know. And there's a lot of learning that I see younger actors do that I'm a little bit suspicious of because the technical learning, the talking about this, what size frame is it, where's this, where's that.
It's none of your business.
Not my business, man. No. It's not your business.
Well, it's because you've got 20 people on that set and they've all got their specific job to do. So you don't see the continuity guy or lady pop up to the gaffer and go, do your job.
So that's a massive thing and that was a big thing. I know we're not talking about specifics, but in Funny Cow, that was so... So it's Friends in Funny Cow. We're made by Friends. and everybody was treated as a grown-up, and everybody was allowed to do their job. I think, again, an increasing trend where younger actors are, and usually the more fuss they're making about other people's job, the less interesting they are doing their job.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a little bit like when somebody forgets their lines. And do we have to have that banging? Or can you not do it?
Well, actually, it's not about them doing that. It's about that you actually don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, I found myself, that's interesting, actually, because I had a little wince, because I found myself in the last couple of jobs doing the, do we have to have that banging? And that's not, and it's not because I forgot my lines. It's not because I forgot my lines. And it's terrible. You have to watch yourself on set. You have to watch yourself doing the policing of other people, you know, because some people just like to, fuck about.
Yeah.
But that's all right, because that's their way of doing things, right? So, yeah. And that's cool. You have to be, I've worked on a couple of noisy sets recently, you know, where people playing, and I kind of find myself, you have to be careful, you know,
But there needs to be some sort of focus.
Yeah, there does.
For everybody.
And you've got to... It seems to me, definitely, that you have to have something to care about, and this is the thing that I care about. This is the thing that we do is the thing that I care about.
Yeah.
And I do care about it.
Do you think there's a need for you to do it? Is it...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And I think a lot of that is to do with upbringing. I think that the template of masculinity I grew up with was men work with their hands and did it. And we can't all be worker bees. And I wasn't a worker bee. So, but if I'm doing my job, I've got to do my job.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I've got to do my job.
I can't... Which kind of contradicts what I said earlier about it being instinct and stuff, but I just mean...
But I think you can be instinctive but still have that that focus and that work ethic. Correct me if I'm wrong, I think what you were saying was about learning. You're not talking about the technicalities, you're going with the gut.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. It's quite a lot of dread in my landscape, but one of my dreads is walking away and people, the idea of people saying, well, he wasn't so bothered. Do you know what I mean?
That's your worry.
Well, I'd hate the idea of people saying, well, he didn't care. He didn't care. Yeah. That'd fill me with.
Would that upset you?
Yeah, it would. Yeah. Because I think, and this is real, but anyway, it's what I believe, so I'll say it. I think that, and I'll use these words, and these words are heavy words to use for the streets I come from, but I believe in art, and I believe that that's what we fight wars for, the music is the most powerful form of communication I know. I don't know anything that touches music. Music's a kind of magic to me.
Yeah.
It blows me to pieces. It tears me to pieces.
Of course.
And I know you've got that. I know you've got that too. I can hear something and it will smash me. It's a cricket bat in my teeth. And I've loved poetry from being a child. Tennyson and Auden and Larkin. As a boy, I loved them, and the best way of saying things. But you have to have the same approach to that as you, all culture, high culture, low culture, because it's all ways of trying to make sense of all this, the fucking drunkenness of being alive, right?
Yeah.
So it's all, that's what it is. So,
and it's kind of everywhere. I mean, I think, you know, I'm not being all wanky or anything, but it's art's everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, I was thinking about you this morning, actually. I was walking over Waterloo Bridge, and I had some headphones on, and it was very it was very jarring music compared to everybody on the commute.
Yes.
And everybody's rushing and their heads down and they've got the trainers on with the suits, the normal.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of walking at my pace and coming towards me, and in my own sort of filmic romantic head, there was a woman and she was reading a book as she was walking.
Beautiful.
And she was obviously really enjoying this book. And all of a sudden, I'm going, this is like a beautiful scene from a film. All these other people rushing. And she's in Technicolor and they're all in black and white. Does that make sense?
It makes more sense than anything that anybody's going to say to me today or perhaps in the next week. And I got to the point where I was sick of apologising for being made that way. If people think it's wonky, I don't care. I really don't
care.
Nor
should you.
As a child, I did it. I said, I do it now. There's always a part of me observing whatever it is. I've got 1,000 stories where I'm in the middle of something and I'm thinking, I can hear the music on this.
Yeah.
I can hear the music in this and I can see that look, that little look and smile there and that little, I can see that. That's what I process. Everything. I've lost people to suicide. I've had terrible, terrible things happen to people in my life, you know, family, loved ones, friends. My first instinct is always to process it into, you know, I write a play about it, or I write a poem about it, or I write a... Yeah, so that's the way I'm made, and that makes absolute sense to me. And
because I know you said that you the learning thing, what you said before, but in a way, because we observe and we see that wink, or we see that smirk or that smile. Subconsciously, I think that's a learning.
I'm not being as articulate as I want to be. I know exactly what you mean, but I think like all words, learning has many meanings. I think there's an instinctual understanding of the emotional language and the weight in people's words. And as a small child, I remember knowing. Very, very young, that what people were saying wasn't necessarily what they were thinking.
Yeah.
And I also remember people talking a lot about things that had no importance because what they were actually saying is, oh, can you fucking, I can't believe I'm alive, can you? I remember thinking that as a young kid. Again, so I think it's, you know, I meet people all the time who talk about art very, very freely because they don't have the baggage that goes with it. You know, they don't feel the need to explain themselves, but yeah, you know, it's a journey to, and quite liberating to be able to say that's who I am. You know,
we were talking not so long ago. I can't remember who it was about caring, and sometimes I've been accused of caring too much.
Yeah.
And also, but I was, I forget who it was. Do you know who it was, Griff? What episode it was? He's shaking his head. He doesn't know. Yeah. But we were talking about some people who do what we do, they don't care.
Yeah.
They should care a bit more. It's not somebody specific or any, it's just certain people who you cross paths with and you go, do you not care a little bit more?
Because motivation's right. What's people's motivation? A lot of the motivation for what we do is ego, and then there's
vanity.
And there's also, there's that tension in all of us, talking acting wise, is there's a neediness there. There's a neediness, and then you despise that neediness in yourself. I've only just realised why I hate my terrier, Ernie. I've got two dogs, one of them's called Ernie, and I hate him because he sits looking at me all day, waiting for a pat, and it reminds me of my neediness. Because I think that's one of the strands of what you do. I mean, I think I do think people should care, and I also don't think we should worry so much about, you know, we live in a world now where we say don't judge. Well, I mean, you know, sometimes if people are there doing the job. See, wrong and right's big words, but sometimes I think people are there for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean.
They're not there to tell stories or to make contact with other people, or to have resonance with people.
Although they're for very different reasons.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me about your gymnasium.
About my gymnasium?
Yeah.
But I'm no longer around.
How did that come about?
What, the boxing gym?
Yeah, can we talk about
it? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So I don't have it anymore.
How did you get into it? Where did that come? Because this came...
I've always had that. I've always had... I'll tell you exactly what the genesis of that. That was... Well, it was twofold. One, if you wanted to like Tennyson and Auden and whoever, like, you had to do a bit of weight training. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I had to do a bit of... I come from a time and a place where men use their bodies physically.
Yeah, a solid working class
working class background where men went out and grafted. And so somewhere inside me, I got that thing, I need to do a bit. So I've trained all my life. I've boxed and done weights, a bit of... And it ended up, I had a place called Tony's Ring when I lived up in Hebden, which it became apparent quite quickly was actually a kind of therapy. So I had people come in there. I'm a great believer in using the body for what it's evolved to do, and I think it's a source of a lot of mental anxiety in people, is that they don't use... Well, we were, you know, there's conjecture over it, but let's say, for argument's sake, 200,000 years old as a species. And up until, you know, very, very recently, we were having to chase meat and pull it down and eat it, catch it and kill it and eat it.
Yeah.
And now, thankfully, you know, we've got Audis and chairs, so, which is good. But I think you need to, and I've definitely known myself that if I work hard in the gym and I let that go through my body, it helps me across the board. So I started boxing classes, teaching in village halls, and then, you know, and then it ended up I got my own boxing gym and had some, I don't know, 100 odd members. And
did you enjoy that? Or was
I enjoyed a couple of aspects. I enjoyed the... I like to see people free themselves a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, I found that immensely rewarding to see. And society, I had a lot of women members, so I found that really powerful as well, that a lot of, you know, women, you know, are told, we're all told to be a certain way, in different ways, but just to let your hands go and to just use your body. So I enjoyed that. And also it was a sense of...
community.
Yeah, sense of community. Right, sense of community and common endeavour, and that everybody was there with doing the best, and nobody was... and the discipline, I was talking about this to somebody the other day, the discipline there was peer discipline, so people would always do... They'd always do the last 20 press-ups because everybody else was, which is usually goes against everything that I'm like, because I believe in the individual, not, you know, but there's something about that I'm going to, because you've done it, I'm going to do it. And that's, watching that in a group is very life-affirming.
Different form of peer pressure.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Do you think, because we know we spoke about the need for creativity before, do you think the need... for training and physicality helps you personally, mentally? Because I know when I train, it really helps me upstairs.
I've got 35 years of evidence. I can't not. I can't not because otherwise it's, I stop. I think the most time I've had off out of a gym in 30 years would probably be 2 weeks, and then it's antidepressants and that. So, no, I absolutely believe in that. I mean, it's, you know...
Would it be that serious if you didn't train, that you would have to take something?
I'm quite happy to... Everybody I know and love has self-medicated all their lives. I mean, and... It's all those things are always hiding places that turn into prisons.
Yeah.
So, and it's always been one, you know, I drank, and I still drink now. I've not stopped, you know. I take sleepers. I need to take sleepers. I occasionally need to take diazes to take the edge off.
As insomnia, we touched on it before. Yeah, Has that always been in your life?
No, do you know what that started when I wrote a sitcom for the BBC? Because it was such a turbulent, unhappy experience. It felt like I was delivering legal papers. But no, it's been there. It's been so I use a physical culty to drain it. But then sometimes it's like I had a German Shepherd and I used to that I trained up and I had to give him to the police in the end, because what I did was I just got him really fit, so fit that he couldn't sit down. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Not just henge, just that sort of. So yeah, I believe in. I absolutely believe, and it's, you know, it's an old. It's not headline news, is it? The Greeks and the Romans knew it, and lots of cultures have known it. That I think I don't think of having a mind and a body. I think I am. I am the body. I am the mind. It's not. Yeah, absolutely. I know, and I don't feel any. I've always needed something to take the edge off a little bit, and then it's easier for people around me.
Are you a big worrier about even, you know, some people worry, and I'm sure my mum won't mind me saying this, and she probably won't even listen.
Sure,
but my mum would worry about the tiniest little things prior to them happening. They might not ever happen.
Sure.
But she would worry.
Sure.
And it'll eat her up.
Okay, I'll tell you. Okay, I have a very specific one. So my mind is on data roaming all the time, and I'm very careful not to let it connect to Wi-Fi, because then I scorch myself. So I've got, I'm writing a radio drama now, I'm writing my next film coming up. So, and I'm aware of this. I've always done this. So I've always got my head full of music and writing and idea and things that I'm going to work on. That stops the focus. And my thing is health anxiety. So I latch onto something, and it's happened through my life. I've had every major life-threatening illness you can think of. I've had none of them. But that's what happens with me.
Yeah.
So once I've had the thought, there's no amount of, you know, I've been taken to.
It's just snowballs.
It's absolutely. It's a tsunami, is what it is. It's a tsunami, and I've been taken to specialists, and I've had scans, and there's a part of me knows, and they're saying it's fine. We've checked the thing, and you're fine. There's nothing. I'm like, right, thank you very much. And then by the time I'm back out in the car, I say, well, they sometimes miss things, don't they? So, yeah. So that's my worry. I'm not a worrier in that sort of. I don't do that, you know, projecting the, oh, they might not like me. I don't do that so much. I think the thing I touched on earlier, I'd be concerned that people thought me inauthentic.
Yeah.
That would be a concern. The rest of it is just, you know, what kind of sordid end.
Because I know people probably listen to this, they'll be listening and they'll go, well, he sounds like the type of bloke that if he's going to do something, he does it 100% or he doesn't do it at all.
Yes. Yes.
And it can be draining.
Oh, it is. It's absolutely. See, that's part of it. That's a big part of it, is watching how draining it is for people around me. That's the real draining part. I can see, and I want to help them out. I think I told you this story when I told you this story of meeting. I was out on a walk and I met a therapist and just walking the dogs. And at the end of the walk, he said, "You've got more trauma in you than anybody I've met in 20 years. And I literally ran back to the house and rang my agent to tell them, because I thought it was a real badge of honour. I thought, what a fantastic... I said, he's been doing it 20-odd years.
What did your agent say?
There's been no calls, but, you know, that. So, yeah, it's a little bit exhausting for all involved, yeah.
Well, yeah. It's never exhausting for me, and I'm chuffed you're my friend, and I'm really, really chuffed that you've come on.
And I'm chuffed you're one of my people.
Thanks, Tony.
Cheers, brother. Thank you.
And there we have it. That was it. I mean, I really love sitting down with Tony anyway, but I especially loved sitting down with him and recording this episode. He's a lovely human being, and I'm really, really chuffed to bits he came on. I hope you enjoyed it. And that was it. That was episode 16. Next week is episode 17. Of course, Craig, we can all count. You know, we've got the Patreon site. If you want to bung us a few quid, that's totally up to you. The podcast will still be free, but you know what it does. I'm not going to blather on about it. If you want to drop us an email, that'd be great. We'd love to know your thoughts on the podcast. We are twoshotpod@gmail.com. And if you want to join us on Twitter, you're always welcome. It's @twoshotpod. Same Instagram, same Facebook. Let us know how you're getting on with it. The responses we've had have been fantastic. We're thrilled. We really love hearing from you. So keep that coming in. Now, you know that we don't have a sponsor for the podcast. Myself and producer Griff, we do this out of our own back pocket. But I need to give a massive, special shout out to Tanya Wade at Maison Bateau, the beautiful patisserie on Greek Street in London. This week we're in London, a venue we were supposed to record at fell through at the very last minute, and she came to our rescue and said, pop yourself downstairs, get your mic set up, no one's going to bother you. So she's been absolutely fantastic. So if you're ever passing Maison Bateau, pop yourself in, grab a coffee, beautiful pastries, great croissants in the morning, get yourself in, say hello to Tanya, and give her a big Two Shot Pod thumbs up. That is it. I shall see you next week. For now, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. This has been the Two Shot Podcast. Thanks so much for downloading. Really appreciate it. Take it easy. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.